Yeah, thank you very much. So I'll discuss indeed the soft gluon exponentiation in multiparton amplitudes. Especially I'll try to concentrate on the recent understanding of how to apply the diagrammatic technique, understanding of exponentiation diagrammatically, which is a generalization, although a non-trivial generalization, of what was understood many years ago about first the abelian theory and then the non-abelian theory, but in the Kolo singlet case. So the main thrust of this talk are these papers here. In particular, I'll cover especially 1 and 2, which appeared about a year ago by two different groups in parallel. And the main message of these is that we can now compute directly in the exponent. So even in the case of multiparton amplitudes, we can compute the soft gluon contribution directly in the exponent. Okay, so to begin, a very short motivation and some introductory comments in order to prepare for what we will need. So we don't need much motivation. It is known to everyone that there is exponentiation, in particular of the singularities of scattering amplitudes. Namely, there is a much simpler structure once you write the amplitude, or at least the singularities of the amplitude, in the form of an exponent, exponential function. So, very roughly, the statement would be that the amplitude with any number of gluons, say, would be the exponential of the amplitude with one gluon. Okay, and of course this is very schematic, this is just the singularities that really exponentiate, but it does carry the message, and to some extent this remains true. Okay, so I'll try to explain precisely how this generalizes to the more complicated non-abelian case. Okay, so this is, of course, great. If we had this situation, we compute one emission, we have the full answer. Okay, that's clearly overly simplified. But an element of truth it carries. So in order to proceed, we want to... okay, first of all, before I build the tools, Why is it interesting? So there are two aspects, basically. One is the theoretical aspect. So obviously, this kind of structure would give us all order information, and this by itself is a good enough motivation to investigate that. We will see that there is a much simpler structure in the exponent, both in today's talk and in tomorrow, in Thomas's talk. So this gives us some insight into all other properties of scattering amplitudes. And the second motivation is resummation. So all of the resummation techniques that we develop are essentially based on exponentiation to begin with. So the fact that we can get any number of emissions from a single one. Now, for the purpose of this talk, it's convenient for me to just consider amplitudes, not cross-sections. So instead of logarithms, which we resum, when we are interested in cross-sections, there will be just poles. This will be in dimensional regularization, so just poles in epsilon. Okay, so in terms of tools, what we need is written here. First of all, the Iconal approximation. So I assume that everyone is familiar with the fact that when we consider soft gluon emission, then the Feynman rules simplify, and the emission of a soft gluon out of a parton, let's say there is some hard process here, the emission of the soft gluon would lead to a Feynman rule which is of the form p mu over p dot k, where p is this momentum and k is the momentum of the gluon, plus I epsilon. A much simpler Feynman rule, but it's not just that it's simple, it has new symmetries. In particular, it does not depend on the spin of this parton that emitted. It would be the same for a quark and a gluon, apart from color factors, which will become important. So, but it does not depend on the spin. And it does not depend on the energy of the particle that emitted the radiation, and this is intuitively clear. Because the gluon is soft, we consider the limit where all the momentum component are smaller than the ones of P, then this guy cannot recoil. I mean, the recoil is negligible, and therefore it continues in a straight line. This Feynman rule, and the fact that it continues in a straight line, this amounts directly to the replacement of these hard partons, as far as the interactions with soft gluons are concerned, with a path-ordered exponential of an integral over the gauge field. And here it will be from 0 to infinity, where infinity in a certain direction, beta, which is dictated by the momentum p. So it will be d lambda beta dot a of lambda beta. So in the soft approximation, we will be replacing all the external hard partons by such Wilson lines. And this precisely gives these iconal Feynman rules, which are the Feynman rules in the soft approximation. Okay, so this is this comment, and I assume that I didn't say anything new to this up to this point. And now we come to actually looking at processes. So we are looking at processes like that in any theory. I hope that this is visible here. So some scattering process of external, say, gluons, two gluons into three gluons in this case. And there is something going in the middle, some hard interaction, which involves high virtualities. And these are the external particles here. And then on top of it, there are some soft exchanges which I've written in blue. And the basic idea is that these long wavelength gluons have momenta which is significantly lower than the momenta of the external partons. In particular, if we want to do it in an invariant way, then we have to state what are all the invariants in this game, and these are pi dot pj. So we assume that all these pi dot pj are significantly larger than lambda QCD. And then we consider exchanges which have momenta which is significantly smaller than pi dot pj. They don't have to have zero energy in the sense that they are non-perturbative. We are definitely using perturbation theory, but much smaller than these scales. What I'll be doing here is take the limit where all of these invariants are going large together. This is called the fixed angle scattering amplitude. So it is in this context that I will analyze soft singularities. So the basic idea is that we iconalize all the external partons as shown here. Okay, so these straight lines that represent the hard partons are now iconal lines like that, each of them in a different direction, beta. So this is beta I, depending on which particle it is, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And each of them can be in a different representation in terms of color, such that in the middle, there is some hard interaction that involves an arbitrary color exchange. Here I drew an example, but really this can be any exchange at any loop order, which I shrink to a point. And the reason I shrink it to a point physically is due to the fact that these long wavelength gluons cannot resolve this. They don't see into the structure of the hard interaction. Okay, so what it means more formally, more mathematically, I am now going to explain in the context of multiplicative renormalizability and its consequences. So here we come to stating results from classical papers in the beginning of the 80s that proved that products of Wilson lines like this, or Wilson lines with cusps, or Wilson lines that self-intersect, or what I will be most interested in, just a bunch of rays that start at zero and end at infinity in different directions, in all these cases, we have multiplicative renormalizability. What it means is that the object that I drew here, which I'm now going to write and define, so I'm going to define S as the vacuum expectation value of a product of phi beta 1 times phi beta 2 times phi beta 3 and so on up to phi beta L, where L is the number of legs. This is my soft function, which carries the same singularities, same soft gluon effects as the original amplitude. So once I've defined this, I like to state that the original amplitude, I'm referring to this factorization still, the amplitude would be this function times h, in some sense that I have to define. What this is factorization between the soft modes and the hard modes, which I explained intuitively on this picture. So the blue ones would be sitting here, and the red ones would be sitting there. To make it more precise, we have to understand that these are color matrices. So, as I said, the soft function knows about color, and therefore it will be actually a matrix in color space, in color flow space. If I want to give this an index j, then this will be jk hk, and I have to sum over k. So this is what I mean by a product, because this bunch of hard exchanges here can have projection on different color flows. And what these soft gluons do is they mix between these different color exchanges. So this is the way I'm going to refer to color. It will be rather formal, not explicit in terms of color order amplitudes.
I have two questions.
Yes.
Why is this not a T product rather than simple product? The second question is, why is it a vacuum expectation rather than a matrix element?
Oh.
It's obvious to everybody else. We can skip my question. I can ask you privately, but it's not.
No, I think it would be good to discuss it privately, because it will take us too much off. Sorry.
What about re-emission contributions? Are you sure?
So this is an amplitude. I'm only discussing the amplitude. So it will be that's the object. The object would be the amplitude to any loop. Then if you have a new, if you have real emission, that's a new object. I'll not be discussing the real emission at this point. Okay. So what I'm so this is the amplitude. So this is the amplitude. The soft gluon exchanges are just factored in here. The rest remains here.
And
this is still imprecise.
Collinear region is in H.
Collinear, let me avoid, sorry. It is very interesting to discuss how one factorizes collinear, but at the moment I would like to take beta I squared. I mean, for the purpose of this talk, it would be best to just not have collinear regions. If there are collinear regions, yes, you're right, one should factorize here into jet factors, which includes collinear singularities as well. The jet factors can be defined in a gauge invariant way, and they depend only on momenta of a single particle, these singularities. They do not involve the rich structure of interference between color and kinematics that I'm going to explore here, and therefore they are not directly relevant for what I'm going to say. But they are very useful, in fact, too, at the end. So I'll just not have time to discuss them.
So this is a collection of N HQETs coupled together, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think, well, for me, it is just a necessary introduction, so I'll not spend too much time. Thomas will return to this in his talk and, in fact, study the properties of this object a bit in more detail. I'll do it in... to proceed, what I did not do here is that I did not renormalize this object yet. So what I should do is I should write here renormalized. Why should I renormalize it? What happens is that because I have shrunk all of these exchanges here, all these loops to a point, introduced a new vertex in the theory which does not exist to begin with, and this vertex requires renormalization. So now I made it finite. Now let me write it in terms of the original object. So I write it like that. S, the original S before renormalization. In order to renormalize, I should have some Z factor, okay, that absorbs all the ultraviolet singularities of this S.
Is there any relative transverse distance between these Wilson lines or not?
No. They meet at a point here. They meet at a point. Okay. And then I write the A. So this is my S renormalized. Okay. And it is understood that there is the product in color space here. All these objects are matrices in color space, including the Z. Now, let us assume that I use dimensional regularization for this S, just pure dimensional regularization, blindly, for this object. What is the answer?
Zero.
Yes. For this loop, integral, it's zero. Exactly. There is no scale. So without any corrections, it's one. So basically, this object, before I separate UV and IR, so if I have here both UV and IR singularities, it is this standard situation where we have 1 over epsilon IR minus 1 over epsilon UV, which is 0. Okay? These are scaleless integrals. It's just scaleless integrals. So in dimensional regularization, I can actually write this as ZH. What is this Z? This Z is the ultraviolet singularities of my correlator here. At the same time, you see this is the infrared singularities of the H. And that's a usual situation when you have a situation like an effective theory. So that's precisely what we have here. Because we iconalized these gluons, we got into a situation where we have this extra vertex, and that's why we need this regularization. This renormalization procedure. Now, what I want to say is that what we are after when we study long-range singularities is, at the end of the day, the renormalization, the ultraviolet singularities of this correlator. Nothing else. Okay? So it's not the finite pieces. I mean, this is one. We converted the problem from a problem of studying the long-distance singularities of the amplitude to another problem, which is to study the ultraviolet singularities of this object. Okay? It is? Yes, in-dimensional regularization. Okay, so what we are after is this Z. Now, here, I already used the fact that my correlator here, S, renormalizes multiplicatively. And this goes back to these papers here that show it in great detail. So I'm going to rely on this. And why is it so important that this renowned, first of all, I've already used this statement here, but one can actually say something about this factor Z from the fact that this corresponds to multiplicative renormalizability of this object. What can we say about it? That the main thing, the first thing, is that it, all these singularities, they can be encoded in a finite anomalous dimension. That, in other words, that we can write define gamma as minus z to the minus 1 dz to d log mu. Okay. So that's a definition. This is, of course, it looks like an evolution equation. We may also want to write it in the other way. If I multiply by z, it looks like that. So this looks like an evolution equation whose solution would be exponential. So in a way, I'm putting by hand the fact that this would be an exponential. But this is not an empty statement, because this, what I said here, multiplicative renormalizability, already tells us that this object gamma is finite. In fact, we know what the dependence, what are the arguments of gamma are. Okay, from very simple considerations, just based on multiplicative renormalizability. So let me give this argument why gamma is special, why is it finite. I mean, from here, it looks that it should not be finite in general, right? Because this object just carries singularities. There are many singularities around, so it should be something should happen so that this combination would be UV finite. And this can be seen directly from what I've written, here, essentially. What I've written is that S renormalized is S times Z. And if I put now arguments on which these functions depend, to make it more precise, what I say is that S renormalized of some kinematic dependence and some mu and m is S of the same kinematic dependence, some epsilon UV and some m, and the Z of the same kinematic dependence, the epsilon UV and mu. I've not written the coupling, but other than the coupling, I've written all the things on which this can depend. Of course, there are also some color matrices inside. Just to make it a little bit more precise, you see, what is gamma ij? Gamma ij would be all the kinematic invariants on which this object here can depend. What can it depend on? It can only depend on things that are rescaling invariant, because these Feynman rules are, right? The Wilson line can be reparameterized, beta goes to k times beta. And therefore, the kinematic invariants would be 2 beta I dot beta j over square root of beta I squared beta j squared. That's the kinematic invariant on which it can depend. These are invariant under rescaling. Okay. Now, let's concentrate on the rest. What is M? M is an infrared regulator. So, when I made this discussion here, I defined everything without an infrared regulator. Now I'm putting a regulator in. Why do I do that? Because I already concluded that what I need is this Z, which are the ultraviolet singularities. So now my task is just to extract the ultraviolet singularities of this object. And obviously, the ultraviolet singularities would not depend on whether or not I use an infrared regulator. But if I want to compute systematically, I must have an infrared regulator. I already told you that these diagrams are all scaleless. So one may try to separate at one loop, it definitely works. One can identify a scaleless integral where there is the UV part and the IR part. One can do it by hand. But at the multi-loop level, it doesn't work. So one needs a regulator. And for the purpose of this talk, it's sufficient that we assume that there is such a regulator. So I put a regulator when I compute this S. And now this S, does not have any infrared singularities. It only has ultraviolet singularities. From now on, I can call epsilon UV epsilon. And this epsilon would be positive. If I define D equals 4 minus 2 epsilon, epsilon will be positive. This is epsilon. So this is my definition of the Z factor, and that's the definition of gamma.
So may I just mention that you actually put an infrared regulator or just simply again with the sign of the epsilon?
No, no, no. I put a regulator in order to compute something, I put a regulator. So initially I did not, but then once I deduced that all I need is the UV singularities, I put a regulator.
An explicit regulator, or is it
just... Okay, for the purpose of this discussion, just let's assume that there is a regulator. We don't even have to discuss what it is.
We don't know what it is.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah, right. So it will not matter for this discussion. So all I want to say is that now we have a standard separation of our variables argument. We can write it in a different way to make the argument easier. S equals S renormalized times Z to the minus 1, okay? And then what I want to say is that this object S here does not have any mu dependence. The mu dependence only comes about once I use the renormalization procedure in order to remove the singularities. That's the essence of this mu. We put it in order, in the process of removing the UV singularities that are related to this multi-iconal vertex.
So I can ask you two stupid questions. One is why beta squared is not zero? Because you chose it to be non-zero.
I chose it to be non-zero just to regulate the collinear singularities by a separate regulator. Let me just get to the point of this discussion because it's kind of an introductory discussion, and then we can make a break for more questions, and then I continue. So the point that I'm getting to is that multiplicative renormalizability and the fact that this initially does not depend on mu tells me that I get the following equation: d to d log mu of S renormalized times z to the minus 1 plus S renormalized times z times d to d log mu of z to the minus 1 equals to 0. And if I multiply by S renormalized to the minus 1 from the left to d log mu, and by z from the right, I get this equality. So basically, what this is telling us is that, I mean, this is gamma. This is the same gamma that we had there. This is a standard separation of argument, separation of variables argument. It tells us that gamma can only depend on the variables that are common to both Z and S because it obeys an evolution equation both in terms of the S and in terms of the Z. Okay? So the Z does not depend on the infrared regulator M. It's just the UV singularities that we extract. The S ren, by definition, does not depend on epsilon because we removed the epsilon singularities in the process of renormalization. And therefore, this should not have, this object should not have either singularities, nor should it have M dependence. So I deduce that gamma is just gamma of gamma ij and alpha s of mu, and through the coupling it can still depend on epsilon, but that's all. If I use a d-dimensional coupling, then it can depend on epsilon in this way, but this is a finite object at any order in perturbation theory. Okay, so now I know something about z, because I know that z obeys an evolution equation with a finite anomalous dimension, and this by itself tells us non-trivial information about z, which are, at the end, the soft singularities that we are interested in. What does it tell us? Okay. Perhaps before I, maybe that's a good place for questions. Okay, so I can, what does it tell us? That there is this evolution equation with a finite anomalous dimension. Well, this calls for saying that z is an exponential function, which is precisely what I want. I want to say that z is an exponential of an integral, say d lambda over lambda, because of this log mu, over gamma of gamma ij and alpha s of lambda and epsilon to infinity from some mu. That would be the solution of this evolution equation. Now you should really stop me, because I cheated a little bit. Exactly. Okay. So I cheated a little bit because I did not take into account the fact that this is actually a matrix. These are all matrices in Kolmogorov space. So the solution of that, only in some very formal sense, which can be called path ordering here, is an exponential. So let us now, for simplicity, take the case of a Sudakov form factor where there is no Kolmogorov flow, just in order to explore the case of an exponential like that. So if I take this hard interaction here, then there is no Kolmogorov flow, these are not matrices, these are numbers, and I really have an exponential. So I can explore this solution. And for sake of simplicity, let me take one extra assumption, and this is that we work in a conformal theory, so I can integrate the coupling easily. So instead of having a complicated beta function, I assume that I work in d dimensions, but plus zero here, n equals 4. Just for simplicity, in order to draw the basic consequences out of that, I make these two assumptions, simplifying assumptions. And with these two assumptions, this would be equal, I can do the integral, and I would get an exponential of 1 over 2 epsilon, sum over n, of the coefficients of this gamma, which I can call gamma n, over n, times alpha s to power n, from 1 to infinity. So I could perform the integration, and what I get out of it is an epsilon in the denominator, that's all. What does it tell me? That, you know, given these simplifying assumptions, the z factor, namely the infrared singularities of our amplitude, are nothing but single poles. It's all just single poles. Okay? No higher order poles. Of course, we are not really interested in this overly simplified case. So let me just write the expression, you know, for the first few orders that we get if we do it right. Namely, if we do not make the assumption that this is a Kolmogorov singlet object, and we do not throw away the coefficients of the beta function, then we get something like that. We get an exponential of 1 over 2 epsilon alpha s gamma 1 plus 1 over 4 epsilon alpha s squared gamma 2 minus beta naught, so the leading coefficient of the beta function, times gamma 1 over epsilon. So you see that already what I said is not quite correct. There is a higher singularity. However, this higher singularity is nothing but iteration of the anomalous dimension we had in the previous order. So it's not new information. The higher singularity is not new. The new thing is always the single pole. And at the next order, I get 1 over 6 epsilon alpha s to power 3 times gamma of 3 plus 1 over 8 epsilon. Notice this is another 1 over epsilon squared term. Gamma of 1 commutator with gamma of 2. And then minus beta 1 gamma of 2 minus beta 0 gamma of 1 minus beta naught squared gamma of 1. And here there is an epsilon, epsilon, and epsilon squared. That's a plus. Okay. Yes. Need something?
Yeah.
What? So, high order.
So
yes.
1 over epsilon squared being the sum of squared things, right?
This one.
Yes. This is going to cancel with what?
Yes, there is an extra singularity due to the running of the coupling, yes.
I'm asking about the physical process.
The physical process. Yeah, so it's true that all the splittings of a gluon would generate that, but this there is some gauge dependence in this. So, which diagrams in the non-abelian theory?
It depends if it is QED, and if the potent starts to
Yeah.
into a pair of light leptons.
Yes,
then
that's true.
The singularity is actually higher.
Yes, yes. It's enhanced by the running of the coupling. That's true. Okay, so now what I want to say is that we find that. Yes.
I can explain one thing. So, if you include the collinear, does that quantum get simpler?
No. It only gets more complicated if I include the collinear. I did not yet say anything about what these are. Notice. No, this is the minimum you can have. In n equals 4, you only have this. Okay? Not quite right, except this. So let me summarize what are the conclusions, why I've written it down. Yes.
Extra 1 over epsilon is the emissions collinear to the soft emission.
It's not. No. It's not. There are no. It's not necessarily the collinear limit.
It will be a photon splitting into E plus or
minus. But they don't have to be collinear. It's not. There are no collinear singularities. It's not collinear singularities. It's.
Once you emit a massless particle, there are collinear singularities, and that's what these.
Possibly. Yeah, it's an integral over the splitting function. That's true. It is.
Yeah. Already independent from the emitter. Emitter already did it.
No. Absolutely. It's not collinear with the emitter. Yeah. It's the integral over the splitting function, if you want. Yes. Okay. These details are a bit side to what I wanted to say. What I want to say is that there are two reasons for higher order poles to appear here. Yes. What I want to say here is that there are two reasons for higher poles to appear. One is due to the fact that the integration over the beta function generates new singularities, and we discussed the physical meaning. The second reason is that there are commutators of lower order terms that do not vanish even in a conformal limit. Even in conformal theory, this persists. which tells us this is precisely related to the fact that I neglected this path ordering, if you want. It's related to the fact that when I consider this multi-iconal vertex, the renormalization is more complicated, and I do get contributions which are iterations of the previous orders in higher orders Poisson epsilon. However, all of these statements do not change the fact that the new ingredient at each order is just a single pole. So if I'm after computing the singularities to higher orders, I should always look for the coefficients of the single pole. In a way, all the others have already been determined by lower order calculations. So we have a prediction for the singularity structure at any given order based on the previous orders, where the new information is the coefficient of the single pole. Okay, so this is just the overview of what we can learn based on multiplicative renormalizability, the fact that we have a finite anomalous dimension. So now we come to the real new part, this is the bulk of the talk, is the diagrammatic exponentiation. Why do we need it? You see, here we did not learn anything about what these things are, really. We want to compute them, okay? Want to compute them, and we also want to develop a picture which we know that this will be much simpler than the full amplitude. So we would like to develop a diagrammatic understanding of what is it that fits in the exponent. And that's why we develop this complementary way of looking at it, which is diagrammatic. What I want you to take out of the previous discussion is precisely this issue about the singularity structure, namely that to first approximation, it's only single poles, and then there are some higher order poles which we control based on the previous orders. Let's now take the abelian case. So now the diagrammatic exponentiation. Yes. Yes. In fact, I will not come to a point of actually computing the gammas, but I will explain the structure of the exponent in a diagrammatic way. So, of course, one can use the same thing to actually compute a gamma. The idea is to compute directly in the exponent rather than to compute the amplitude and then see that it factorizes and extract the coefficients out of the calculation of the full amplitude. We would like to be able to compute directly in the exponent. So how to do that? In the abelian theory, you see the situation is very clear, very intuitive. What happens is that if I write the soft gluon amplitude, it's an exponential of the following diagrams of this diagram. Let's take a form factor for simplicity, and there would be also this diagram. And eventually there would also be this type of light-by-light diagram. These diagrams definitely appear in the exponent. However, other diagrams, like this one, should not be included in the exponent. I know it in advance. What I know is that this, as well as this, would be fully reproduced by expanding this exponential function. If I take the second order term, okay, take this, then expand it, then I will get it 1 plus e plus e squared over 2 plus dot dot dot, where e is the thing that sits here, and out of the e squared over 2, I will discover this and that. So there is no need to take this into account when I compute the exponent. This is precisely, it should remind us, the fact that in field theory, we do not have to worry about disconnected diagrams. Now, why are these disconnected diagrams? So there is a sense in which these are disconnected diagrams and these are connected diagrams. What is this sense? I have to remove these icona lines here. After I've removed these icona lines, these remain disconnected diagrams and these are connected diagrams. Why do I have to remove these icona lines when I consider that? Because if I will later on write the expression, I think about it in a field theory way, then these are actually sources for my soft gluon radiation. These lines are actually sources, and therefore they are not part of the quantum mechanical process that I am describing. So the way to think about it is that these are disconnected diagrams, and they should not be included in the exponent. Very good. Situation is extremely simple in the abelian case, and this goes back to the 60s. Yes, we can. Yes, yes. We see that we have only a small subset of diagrams, which are these, which should appear in the exponent. Now, let's go to a bit more complicated case. And this is now the non-abelian case. I still want to consider the form factor in the non-abelian case. So let's take and think about, okay, this diagram is obviously here, but then at the next order, we have new type of diagrams like these. This certainly it should appear in the exponent because it would not be related to exponentiating that. This is obvious, but what is less obvious, I mean, this is clear, it would be reproduced by exponentiating that, but this, here we find the new aspect. So, no, this is a group, does not touch it, okay? So this is just a cross diagram. The cross diagram should appear in the exponent. This is the content, basically, of these papers from the 80s that I'm describing. This diagram should appear in the exponent because when you exponentiate this diagram, you do not reproduce that correctly. In fact, you reproduce part of it. You reproduce the abelian part of the color factor. So you kind of reproduce it with a wrong color factor. So if this one has a color factor which is CA times, which is CF, if these are fundamental ones, times CA minus 2CF, then in the exponent, it should appear with the coefficient CFCA, because the part which is CF squared is already obtained by the first order. And this color factor that I've written here is what is called sometimes the modified color factor or the exponentiated color factor, which is the color factor that is associated with a given diagram when this diagram is written in the exponent. What are new color factors when we compute in the exponent? Now I'd like to get to a bit a deeper point, which is already possible, which is possible to see when we consider exponentiation in the non-abelian theory for a color singlet object. And this is what was analyzed in the 80s, color singlet object. So the deeper issue is the following correspondence. It's a correspondence between the singularities and color structure. So the color structure of this diagram is irreducible. And so is the color structure of this diagram. The color structure of this diagram here is reducible. Or another name for it here is that it is not color connected. Reducible color structure, what it means is that if I have diagram D, then I can write it as a product of subdiagram H1 and subdiagram H2. It's a product of two color factors of some subdiagrams. It turns out that color reducibility in the context of Kolmogorov singlet objects is in one-to-one correspondence with another property, which is the presence of subdivergences. Not any subdivergences, subdivergences that are related to the renormalization of the cusp of this place, of this point where the two icon lines meet. So if I draw a box that includes this vertex that takes part of the diagram into account, if I do that and shrink this box to the cusp without doing anything for the rest, then I discover a subdivergence. This would lead to a 1 over epsilon squared singularity. And you see that, in fact, all the diagrams are in one of two groups. Either they have an irreducible Kolmogorov structure, like these, and then they have no subdivergences at all. I'll write it here, no subdivergences. Or they have a reducible Kolmogorov structure, but then they have subdivergences. So there is one-to-one correspondence between the two. Why does it make me happy? Because I know that when I look at the exponent, I should only be finding single poles. The anomalous dimension, forget about the beta function for a second. The anomalous dimension appears in the exponent with just 1 over epsilon. So contributions to the exponent should not have subdivergences. If they have subdivergences, it means they would have higher poles, and higher poles should not appear in the exponent, apart if they are related from to the renormalization of the coupling.
So with gentlemen with regular vertex, why does it have a subdivergence?
It does not have a subdivergence which is related to the renormalization of the cusp. I cannot draw a box around a sub-diagram of it, shrink it to the cusp, and still remain with some gluons that are not touched. Yes. Yes, not all subdivergences. Of course, this diagram here has a subdivergence which is related to shrinking this one, as we discussed before, in the context of the beta function. Yes, there are subdivergences related to integrating over the coupling, to the coupling. Yes, exactly. I shrink whatever I can shrink by putting a box around some subdiagram. I shrink it to the cusp, and then I continue. And in this way, I can count how many, what is the strength of the subdivergence, how many subdivergences I have. And there are many related combinatorial objects, such as in how many ways I can shrink it, what is the order in which I do it, because in the multi-iconal case, there are different ways to do it. The non-planar two-loop vertex. This one. No, what? This diagram.
There's no 1 over epsilon squared.
This one has no 1 over epsilon squared.
How can I get the CF squared term from the
I will explain the Kolmogorov factors later on.
One over epsilon. The one vertex is CF over epsilon.
The one. This one. I mean, this one.
The CF squared part of the non-planar box.
Also non-planar box. Which box?
Non-planar triangle. Sorry.
Yes. Two triangle. You are talking a real triangle or an iconal? You take this. Yes.
You have the minus two CF squared.
You ask this. Yes. Yes. Yes.
You cancel.
I will show the general method in which. Okay. I will show the general method in which we compute these modified Kolmogorov factors, which is new, and then we can discuss this particular case.
Martin is completely correct, but what he's going to do is he's going to drop the piece that you were worried about.
Okay, he's going to multiply the same by modified color.
He doesn't literally get the
yes,
that piece from the equalization.
Yes,
so I'm going to drop it.
I did not yet explain how I compute the modified color factors, but I don't want to do it in this context. I want to show the new method to do it, which is general, and that is, yes.
So, for example, if I take this large center of mass energy,
yes.
I will factorize this gamma ij, it will get outside of the exponential. You see, you have a capital gamma.
How do you know?
Because in the energy limit, then you get these two of these virtual lines, get the large angle, this log of s, it gets outside of the exponential, and this is all consistent with the two-loop calculation of the radiation gradient at the order, next to order, in any quarter of pyramids, and this is it's exactly consistent with that. And the divergences that are here cancel against the real emission path that they are discussing.
I can show you exactly what happens in the energy limit, but we have to proceed. Huh? There is quite a lot. I don't know where we are in terms of time. I'm basically, let's see where I am. I basically start, I'm here.
Just finish the introduction, come on.
No. No, but this is the interesting part.
Yes.
So. If someone is not interested in the interesting part, it's a good idea to leave. So what I'll do at the end is that I'll show you a few slides which will go a bit faster, but I wanted to make the let's see how I can do it a bit quicker. So what I want to show you now is that what I said so far about the this color singlet case actually completely breaks down when we go to the multi-leg case. Okay, so let us erase this. I mean, we saw that there is a very nice correspondence between the presence or absence of subdivergences and the reducibility or non-reducibility of color factors. Now, I'd like to show you that this, on the face of it, we lost everything when we go to this case, okay? This, consider that. This is a diagram, two-loop diagram, that would contribute to the renormalization of the two-loop vertex here, okay, for four particles. The question that I want to ask is whether this diagram or it's rather this one are obtained by exponentiating one loop results. And if they could be obtained, it would be from exponentiating such diagrams like that. Right? So the question is, do we obtain them or not from the expansion of this exponential? So, in order, let's do this exercise in detail, as a last exercise I do in detail. It's non-abelian now. I mean, non-abelian and general color structure here, very general. So now, what I'll show you is that we lose this correspondence, namely these diagrams would actually appear in the exponent. Let's do it. So I want to write this diagram, let's call it D1 and D2. D1 I will write as F of gamma 1, 2, this invariant here. This leg would be called 1, 2, and 3. Again, 1, 2, and 3. And the column factor would be T1A, T2A, and I sum over A. And diagram T2 would be F of gamma 2,3 times T2B, I call it B now, and T3B. I call it a different name because I like to multiply the two, so I don't want the index to appear twice. Now, when I expand the exponential, what I'll get is clearly 1 plus d1 plus d2 plus half of d1 plus d2 squared. Out of this, the interesting bit is half of d1 d2 plus d2 d1. Why is this written like that rather than with a 2? Because the color matrices obviously do not commute along line 2. Line 2, these are two different non-abelian generators along the same line. The order matters. If I compute... I mean, these are...
They're not multiplied together. What is
the... These, in terms of their indices, this is I, J, and K, L.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. So remember that there is a hard interaction here that that joins all these indices together at the end. So we have D1, D2, plus D2, D1. What it is a half, I wrote this, half f of gamma 1, 2 times f of gamma 2, 3. This factors out. And then I have T1a, T2a, T2b, T3b, plus T2b, T3b, T1a, T2a. And the only thing that matters here is actually the order of the two T2s, because there is an external product between the different legs. But along the line 2, the order definitely matters. So what we got here is TA, TB, TB, TA, where the A and the B, you know, the A is always the one that connects to leg 1, and the B is always the one that connects to leg 3. Essentially, what we got here in terms of color is the color factor of diagram, let's call it 2A, and diagram 2B, 2 for being two loops. So it's the color factor of diagram 2A times the color, plus the color factor of diagram 2B. And what is this? The kinematic dependence here. The kinematic dependence is just, look, this is an integral. I have an integral along this line, if I do the calculation in configuration space, from 0 to infinity ds, where s is the parameter going along the line here too. And here, there would be another integral from 0 to infinity dt for this parameter that goes along this line but connects now to leg 3. When I multiply two such integrals by each other, these two, it's the same as writing it with a theta s larger than t plus a theta s smaller than t. That's a unit. Okay? Basically, what it tells me, in the case s larger than t, I got this diagram. And in case s smaller than t, I got this diagram. So the product of two kinematic factors is nothing but what I want, namely f of 2a plus f of 2b. This additivity of the integration ranges is a completely general feature. And what you see is that if we did not have color factors around, okay, if this color factor, I mean, these matrices were 1, then this would have been 2. And here, you see, as in the abelian case, we just get the sum over the two loop diagrams. So if there was no color about, the exponentiation of these would just give that exactly. However, there is color. And color messes things up, because instead of getting these diagrams, what do we expect to get in an amplitude after the expansion of the exponential? What we expect to get is the kinematic dependence of diagram 2a times the color dependence of diagram 2a plus the kinematic dependence of diagram 2b times the color dependence of diagram 2b. What we got instead is the sum over kinematic dependences of the two times the sum over the color. So that's not the correct result. What is missing here is actually the antisymmetric combination. We got the symmetric combination of the two, namely in the exponent, we should have half of F2A plus a minus F2B times C2A minus C2B. Yes. That's the missing part, the antisymmetry. And this should appear directly in the exponent at the two-loop order. So what we conclude is that these diagrams, that are reducible diagrams, must appear in the exponent. That's already shocking news, because what we saw previously is that we did not have any reducible diagrams in the exponent, and in this way we also did not get any subdivergences in the exponent, and we were happy because this is consistent with the renormalization properties of this object. Now, we see that this breaks down. Reducible diagrams do appear in the exponent, evidently. So, our only hope is that there would be some cancellations about that would save the day, and we would get a structure which is consistent with the renormalization of this object. And indeed, these cancellations do appear, and they appear in a beautiful way. What we get here is, in fact, a linear combination of kinematic factors times a linear combination of color factors. And it is this linear combination that makes sure that we get the right cancellations about. In fact, we get correspondence here between what we get on the kinematic side and the color side. In terms of color, this has a non-abelian color structure. This should remind us something, the maximal non-abelian color structure that we got in the case that I erase, in the case of the color singlet object, the fact that we only got the CA piece. Here, this is obviously a commutator. It would be a commutator T2A, T2B, minus T2B, T2A, which would be FABC, T2C. So we do recover this property of a non-abelian color structure. And in terms of kinematics, this and that, each of them has a double pole. But the double poles are the same. The double poles between this and that do not depend on what I shrink first. I can shrink this one first or shrink this one first. One can check. The double poles would always be the same. So what it means is that this is order 1 over epsilon, as it should be in order to contribute properly to the anomalous dimension there. Okay? So what we discover is that webs in the multiparton case are not individual diagrams. Individual diagrams have bad properties. They don't have the right color structure. They have subdivergences. However, the combinations of diagrams that appear in the exponent, to which we assign the name webs, or multiparton webs, they do have the good properties. They have a non-abelian color structure, and they do not have the subdivergences because of cancellations.
Are the combinations of the kinematic factors the same as always, the same as the combinations?
So this is, obviously Bose symmetry has to be realized in a certain way, but it is not always the same combinations. So I'll give you some examples. I mean, it is more complicated than that. But perhaps given the time, I would go and show you a few slides now in order to make it a bit faster. So we can get to the main points, you know, without spending another hour. So, Yes.
Brandt, Mary, discuss this. I mean, this would
no.
Not there, then multiplicative normalization would be violated.
Yes. However, this was they actually never discussed. So in these papers, yes, but they never discussed the color and kinematic structure in detail.
That's a missing part then, so you say the proof of multiplicative...
No, it's not, I mean, the proof holds, however, the way it's realized, I mean, what we're investigating now is more putting together two things and trying to see how it is realized in a diagrammatic way. So we do it...
The proof was diagrammatic too, that's
Yes. However, it did not go into identifying the dependence on the kinematics and the dependence on the color. Okay, so let me show what we get. So what we get is that the exponent, let's forget about what I showed you in the beginning about multiplicative renormalizability and anomalous dimensions, because all of what I say here follows independently of that. Later, it's very good to put these two things together. But what I wrote here is that one can diagrammatically obtain that the soft function can be written as an exponential sum of webs, where each web is a sum over a set of diagrams of kinematic factors times modified color factors. So the only difference as compared to the color singlet case that was known before is that one has to sum over a particular set of diagrams. What is the set of diagrams in general? It would be all those diagrams that are related to each other by permutation of the gluon attachments along the iconal lines. You saw that I took 2A and 2B now, both of them. These are the entire set of diagrams that together form a web. Now, these modified color factors are themselves a linear combination. We saw that we got the difference of color factors of the two diagrams. These are just linear combinations of the ordinary color factors of the diagrams in the set. So we write it like that. And what we get is a mixing matrix, R, which are just numbers, that involves mixing between the set of vector of kinematic functions corresponding to all the diagrams in the set, matrix of numbers, and then vector of color factors corresponding to all the diagrams in the set. This is a general structure. And now, this is not related. And then this is the general structure that we get out of every web. Okay, so now I will skip. So I don't know. Yes.
The three gluon coupling is part of the same web.
The three gluon coupling is a web on its own. It's like in the case of the color singlet. It was a web to begin with.
It's irreducible.
There is no problem.
To this other web.
But it's the same color structure.
Yeah, it's not about gauge. That's true. It's not about gauge invariance.
So these webs are gauge dependent.
They are gauge dependent in general.
But they have the same color structure.
Yes. They would give the same color structure. So webs would always give these non-abelian color structures, right?
So why don't you pull them together and?
Yeah, you should at the end. You must when a computer. Okay. So what I want to say is that we have a general method of computing these matrices R. So what I showed you is that this structure emerges. I showed you a very simple example where it emerges. But actually, there is a very general method to compute it, which I will not explain here because it will, I'm afraid, take too much time. But basically, the idea is that, I mean, we write here a generating functional for the soft gluon field. So, well, you know, these are sources. So this is a generating functional that generates all the diagrams that you can have, all the ones that we discussed. These are just this is the correlator we are interested to compute. And then instead of computing this generating functional, what we want is the log of it, because we would like to write it as an exponential of something. And the idea of the replica trick is just a way to derive the Feynman rules that directly correspond to computing the log of Z. So I'll be happy to explain the replica trick to anyone interested. It's a very simple algorithm. And what it gives you is the Feynman rules to compute directly the log of Z. So what I want to show you before I finish is a few results. And then discuss the properties of the web mixing matrices. So this is, I prepared it as a way to demonstrate the way the replica trick applies, so I'll not go through the details, but basically what it shows you is that you get these particular linear combinations of color factors of the diagrams in the set. Here we have a set of four diagrams, of four three-loop diagrams. That's the color factor, that's the, in red, is the modified color factor of diagram A. And at the end, out of this set of four matrices, all you get is one linear combination. This is the linear combination of kinematic factors times this linear combination of color factors. So, Zvi, to your question, it's not the same linear combination. It's, in general, a different linear combination. All the information is encoded in the mixing matrix, which you see here. Yes?
Hussein, can you assume exponentiation? You use a formal method that computes the logarithm. And as long as exponentiation is correct, you get the logarithm.
You can put it this way, yeah? In fact, there is not much of an assumption here, because exponentiation without stating what the exponent is an obvious thing. It's just one can write it in terms of an exponential function. What is nice is that when you write it in the form of an exponential function, it gets very simple in the exponent. So when I gave this talk in front of...
No. That's still a miracle.
Exactly. So, very good. So, from the point of view of these are just combinatorial objects. And in fact, I can show you here, this is a formula, which is a combinatorial formula to get this matrix, or these modified color factors, and similarly for the matrix. It's something that may arise in a different mathematical context. And indeed, there are a couple of people that are doing research in combinatorics that got interested in this. So it is just a combinatorial object. It's just numbers. And if you normalize it properly, multiplying by a factorial, it is even a matrix of integers. So you saw that the way I normalized it, they're just integer numbers sitting here inside. So now, what is nice is that this matrix, which is just very simple combinatorial object, encodes all this important information about cancellation of subdivergences, about the non-abelian color structure. It's all there. Okay.
So the top line, every term here has a 1/ε³ divergence.
Absolutely.
The cancellation of the 1/ε³ is kind of obvious, but the cancellation of the 1/ε² is definitely not obvious.
Yeah, it should not cancel. And remember this term here? This term here, so I did not get to discuss the 1/ε², but that's the first example where a commutator of gammas, namely two loop webs multiplying one loop webs, yes, becomes non-trivial. As a result, it should not cancel, but it should match the previous orders.
But all of the
and it matches.
Functions are totally non-obvious in this.
No, absolutely.
You have to compute it and see that it works.
Exactly. And that's why these matrices should contain a lot of miracles in a way that are not obvious from the beginning. Okay.
Argument about the multiplication, normalization works for these things as well. So in this sense, you don't need to test.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But the way it is realized is precisely the nice thing. So what it would translate to, what it would translate to are properties of these web mixing matrices, as well as properties of the way these multi-loop diagrams factorize in some approximation to, in fact, it is, these would be sums of products of lower loop diagrams.
So is this better than the standard method of just computing the...
We compute directly in the exponent. We avoid, first of all, we avoid...
What is avoided?
Several diagrams. Several diagrams are avoided, and then you don't need, I mean, this to extract the exponent.
There's a line on the board, yes, which is partially covered, right? Which came,
yes,
from the old box.
This one, yes, yeah, yes. How do you compute the gammas?
Predict what you should get. You should compute the gammas.
Exactly. So we got right. So indeed, but what you never get is the new thing. I mean, you need a method to compute the new thing, right? The new thing is covered, but it's gamma 3, which has just a single pole. You need a diagrammatic method to compute the new thing, okay? And that gives you directly the
different method of computing just the gamma.
Well, you can compute the amplitude and compare it and factorize the amplitude and extract that. Yeah.
No, but can you just compute these 3D diagrams, all of them?
Right? Yes, we've done that for this set.
Yeah, without anywhere else. Can this happen? I mean, is it
possible? Yes, you
compute on the exponent, but you know that you have to find one where it's on four.
We compute, we compute diagrams, but at the end, we put them together in a certain way that we are told by the web mixing matrices, and that is where things should happen to match the structure. This structure works web by web. Okay, what I've written here for these gammas, you can look web by web after you have combined the right set of diagrams and see that we have done it. I mean, this gamma 1 and gamma 2 commutator agrees, okay, when we put one loop and two loop information with what we get, we compute this web. Okay? Okay, so now let me give you one last example. This is this set of four loop diagrams. This is the corresponding web mixing matrix. So this is a notation for which diagram it is. What this is basically telling you is that there is a computer program. Obviously, I did not go and compute it by hand, although it's a fairly quick algorithm to compute for such large matrices. We better use a computer program, and indeed, I wrote a maple code that does it for a general web, so we can automatically get them. And the nicest thing is, because we could automatically compute them, is that we started discovering these properties that, as we predicted here in the discussion, should somehow come about, because we expect all this structure to be there. And what we discovered are the following, I mean, these are the first properties we discovered, but there are more. These are some of the properties of these matrices. In particular, all these matrices are idempotent. So this was first discovered by just looking at the eigenvalues. We found that all the eigenvalues are 0 and 1. Okay? If that matrix, indeed the matrix is idempotent, which we have now proven to be general, they are always like that. What it means is that these are projection operators. That projection operator, they act on the space of kinematic factors or on the space of color factors and project onto a particular subspace. What is the subspace? The subspace of contributions to the exponent. What is the remaining diagram? These are the diagrams that are fully reproduced by expanding the exponential of the lower orders. So this is a projection operator, this web mixing matrix. Let me show you how it works. This is shown here. So the web, as I've written it, as a kinematic factors, web mixing matrices, color matrix. Now inserted the diagonalizing matrix Y, Y minus 1, Y here and here. The object that I've written in the middle, YR, Y minus 1, because Y is chosen to be the diagonalizing matrix, is just a diagonal one. But because R squared equals R, this is a diagonal matrix of 1s and then zeros. So the sum, when I multiply it out, would include only the first R elements, which is the number of eigenvalues that are 1. Now, D eigenvalues, D is the dimension, R is the rank of this matrix, and there are only R eigenvalues that I have to sum over. And this means that there are R linear combination of kinematic factors multiplying corresponding combinations of color factors that enter the exponent. Okay, so this is the contribution of this set of diagrams to the exponent. And then these linear combinations are precisely the ones in which this cancellation of subdivergences occur, and these linear combinations are precisely the one that generate the non-abelian structure. Okay, so let me conclude. I mean, there are many other things to discuss, but I've taken enough time.
So R is the number of color pairs you're
going
to sum.
No, it's not the number of color flows. Okay. It's in each, so it's not related. So it's related to the set of particular diagrams. It would be. It's not related to which you know to the entire correlator. So in a particular set of diagrams, you may actually exchange gluons only between a subset of your external lines. So the number of color flows in the hard interaction involves all the lines. So it is just peculiar to the particular set of diagrams that you have chosen the rank. It's one of the properties of this web. Yes, yes. Okay. Let me summarize. So what I've shown is that diagrammatic exponentiation can be extended, has been extended to this multi-parton case. So the generalization, as you saw, is non-trivial because in the color singlet case, webs were just individual diagrams. Okay, the color factors was modified compared to the original one, but there were individual diagrams. Here, the properties of webs, namely the singularity structure, the color structure, appears after we sum a set of diagrams, and the set, as I showed you, is all the diagrams that are related to each other by permuting the gluon attachments. I've not shown in detail, but there is a general formula for the web mixing matrices that is basically a combinatorial formula. And then, since we have a general program that allows to compute it, we started discovering some properties initially accidentally, but then managed to prove them to be general. We now know several interesting properties of the web mixing matrices, and this starts to feed into the understanding of the structure of the exponent in general. In particular, what we are doing now in this paper, which is about to appear, is we look precisely at how the singularity structure from multiplicative renormalizability is recovered thanks to the properties of the web mixing matrices. Okay, so what it involves is the properties of the web mixing matrices as well as the properties the way in which a multi-loop diagram kind of factorizes into smaller, lower loop diagrams. Yes?
There was a paper by Dositzer and Marchesini
yes.
6 years ago where yes. they calculated this matrix of anomalous dimension. And indeed, in this matrix, of course, you have a combination of this gamma ij, which is the kinematics, and your color.
Yes.
And then in a certain limit, I forgot, but I think it was Lapp's angle limit, they saw that the eigenvalue of the anomalous dimension matrix was symmetric. There was a duality between yes. kinematics and color, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
So I guess it is possible to generalize these dualities.
Yes. There are several ways in which color and kinematics looks like a mirror of each other. It's that's one way. There are other ways. In fact, in the talk tomorrow, Thomas will show you that there is an ansatz for the all-order result of the anomalous dimension in the massless case. Well, what you get is a dipole structure, which means that you have a log of the dot product of the velocities beta I beta j multiplied by ti dot tj. So there is really one-to-one correspondence. In the massive case, this is more complicated. Okay. I'm happy to discuss any of this in more detail. There is much more to discuss.
How do you identify the sets that reduce the diagrams? I mean, you take all reducible diagrams, but then you break them into subgroups.
Yes, so the groups. So they would never mix with diagrams that are, well, all the ones that we will mix into would be ones that are related to them by permuting the gluon attachments along some line. So you take all, it's essentially the symmetric group acting on each of the lines for which you have more than one attachment. That's the total number of diagrams in the set.
So I have a very naive question.
Yes.
So what is the profit of this?
So you
can now make more efficient calculation all the time, all the anomalous dimension of this.
Yes. Okay. So I think you already kind of hinted on the two directions. One is indeed to have a more efficient way of computing these to higher orders, and at three loops we basically have no results at the moment. I mean, we have some beginning, but no results. Yes, exactly. So that's one direction. And the other direction is through the discovery of general properties, the idea is to understand all order structure. I think we already know some very general properties, but they at the moment, they are restricted to the level of individual webs. And I anticipate that this would develop into understanding of the general, for example, correspondence between color and kinematics in the exponent.
Yes. Let me just comment about one more profit of this consideration to my mind. In that original work by Brandner and Sutter, which you mentioned, okay, where they proved renormalization, as far as I remember, it was a perfect proof for, I mean, loops with cusps, okay? Okay. And actually, for the loops with self-intersections, it was always a problem that the matrix of anomalous dimensions appeared at finite end because of so-called Mandelstam relations between the Wilson loops. I mean, mm-hmm. The indices were closed.
Yes.
Okay, so to my mind, I mean, you just accurately analyze, I mean, this case of, I mean, the self-intersecting loops, okay, both in the case of infrared. Okay, and as I understand, I mean, in the case of, I mean, ultraviolet divergences as well.
So as far as the analysis is concerned, it's essentially only ultraviolet because the infrared is obtained from the ultraviolet. But if I, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yes, good, thank you.
So then, with no more questions, thanks, and I'm very much.